Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats, silence your cell phones, for you are now listening to Much Ado About Wrestling!
Welcome, fair listeners. It's Much Ado About Wrestling, and you know what that means. I'm one half of your scholarly presenters, Andrew Terrence Caberline, and with me, as always, is Mr. Tyler Ward. Tyler, how are you today?
I'm doing good, Andrew. It is a new year. How are you doing?
Yeah. I'm doing okay. I'm happy to be in the new year as well. Mm-hmm. The subject matter that's going to dominate most of today's episode is somber. Mm-hmm. But I guess we've had a little over a week now to let it hit us. Mm-hmm. So most of today's episode is going to be in remembrance of John Huber, better known recently in AEW as Mr. Brody Lee. Mm-hmm. And known in WWE as Luke Harper, who he passed away unexpectedly and recently, and we're going to be talking about his career, what happened at the end, and what kind of legacy he's going to leave on wrestling in both the immediate and in the future. So there's a barrel of laughs that we're going to get into later. So with that kind of down open, now let's talk about Wrestle Kingdom 15.
Guys,
for a
Wrestle
little bit.
Kingdom was last night.
Wrestle Kingdom was the last two nights.
Yes, it was.
So again, this is the second year in a row that it took place over two nights. Mm-hmm. New Japan Pro Wrestling's biggest show of the year, and like the biggest show of the year in Japanese wrestling, even predating New Japan. Mm-hmm. The January 4th Tokyo Dome show is their WrestleMania.
Yep.
The big main event on night one saw the climbing to the top of the mountain for Kota Ibushi, who secured the IWGP Heavyweight and Intercontinental Championship, took him off of Naito. Mm-hmm. And then the main event of night two was him successfully defending it against Jay White in the main event.
Yes.
Tyler, to you, what are the big headlines coming out of Wrestle Kingdom 15?
Just like Ibushi finally did it. He finally did it. He's won the G1 before, and he's failed at Wrestle Kingdom. He's gone to Wrestle Kingdom without the G1 before, and he failed. But he has finally done it. He has captured the heavyweight title, the Intercontinental title. I'm super excited about that. I think, because when Sarah and I were, you know, reviewing the results and we found out what happened, I started geeking out just like a 7-year-old boy, because mm-hmm. I was like, oh boy, the stars are aligning. We're gonna get the dream match against Kenny.
Was this at like 7:30 in the morning too?
No, this was like this might have been at like 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
This, because we had found, this was when I knew that Ibushi won the titles, but he hadn't defended them yet, so mm-hmm. I was just like, oh boy, here we go. But yeah, I'm super excited for the possibilities. They haven't even like given us anything concrete yet. It's all speculation right now. But I think like it feels like we could be leading towards that if this supposed mm-hmm. working relationship with AEW and New Japan.
And by that, of course, you mean former lovers, best friends,
yes.
Kota Ibushi now with multiple gold belts, putting them on the line in the long-awaited one-on-one contest with Kenny Omega, who also will have multiple belts.
Gold belts, yep.
Yeah, I feel like if it's going to happen, we're probably quite a ways from it happening.
Yeah, yeah. I think Kenny needs to collect a few more belts.
Yeah.
But it's the potential is great. I will, full disclosure, we haven't watched Wrestle Kingdom mm-hmm. yet. I definitely want to go back and watch the matches, especially Okada versus Ospreay from the first night.
Yeah.
man, I was super excited for this one, and I bet it was an absolute incredible match.
Yeah, beyond the main events, I've heard that that match is fantastic. I've heard that Shingo Takagi and Jeff Cobb was fantastic.
Yep.
And I've heard really good things about Hiromu Takahashi and Taiji Ishimori as well.
Yep.
Those were kind of the standouts, the way that I heard it.
Yeah.
Let's get into Kota Ibushi versus Kenny potentially in a second. But first, I want to say that for me, the headline of the night was passing of the guard of the torch in New Japan, and that the recent big names at the top of the card, other than Kenny, who is like gone from the company, but it's shocking to me that Tanahashi and Okada don't show up in any capacity on night two. Or in any main event capacity either. And like Okada versus Ospreay as a semi-main event on night one is like a great position, but it's and Naito too, like the person who had climbed the mountain proverbially before Ibushi. You have three people who were really carrying the company in the later half of the decade who don't get the spotlight on night two. I think that's really fascinating to me, and I'm curious to see if for the next year, if Okada and Naito will kind of be the elder statesman, which is crazy to say because Okada is still so young.
I was going
to
say Okada is a very
old young, 27 or whatever he
is. Well, he's I think he's at least like 31 now, maybe.
He's 33. Okay. I just confirmed.
But comparatively, Kota is 38, I think.
Yeah, but looks not a day over 13 years
old. So. Yes, but looks like a young man.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see if this is the coming out party, not just for Kota, but for Kenta in New Japan, feels like a young person because he had never been to Japan before.
Yeah.
For Sanada, for Hiromu, and for Evil, which we've already seen this year. Like is this the time that they're going to try to build new stars?
I mean, just my opinion, I think so. I think there's a weird bleed over of like the old guard being like, you know, Tanahashi, Naito, maybe you could put Okada in there just because he's been at it so long. But given the age difference, like I think we know Tanahashi is on his way out. Okada, I mean, God, that dude's still got a good 10, 15 years left in him. But then you do have younger guys coming up, who guys like Jay White, guys like Sanada, Ospreay, who are still very young and still have so high to go. It's a weird, like, I feel like everyone...
Someone like
kind
Juice
of
Robinson, too, sorry, who, like, Juice missed Robinson. This card because of an injury, but...
I feel like everyone kind of exists on the same sort of play in here in terms of, like, you know... Because, again, New Japan is so good at making you believe anyone can be a contender at any point. Like,
that is true.
Evil was the IWGP heavyweight champion this year. Like, let's not forget that.
That is true. So let's go back to the major potential storyline of Kota Ibushi versus Kenny Omega. For this to happen, they both have to keep at least one of their titles for quite a while. Logistically, when do you see this match happening and where? What makes sense to you?
Man, so it depends on a lot of things. I think, weirdly, it depends most on the negotiations between AEW and New Japan, specifically on who is going to go over. For me, an ideal situation would be for it to take place at Wrestle Kingdom. And that's just because the history that Kota and Kenny have within Japan, within New Japan, like everything began there. It's storybook ending for have it to end there. That's this ultimate climax they're building to. But it would arguably be much better for the American audience, for AEW, if it happened in an AEW ring, like, you know, something like that. Ideally, maybe AEW could find a way to broadcast like a joint show with New Japan. Hopefully in a year from now, you know, travel is not as complicated. But I really, it depends on who's going over. Because, like, to me, it makes sense. Kota has to win, right? Kota's probably going to be the face in this. Kota's got to win. So I don't see AEW building up Kenny that, like, for a year as, like, the old, like, the champion of everywhere to have him lose to another company's top guy. I don't know.
I could see, here's the world where this happens within 2021, the calendar year.
Okay.
I think you're right that, like, a joint show makes sense. I bet you that they would prefer to have it be a joint show right around WrestleMania to try to suck the air out of that. I think it will happen on American soil.
Yeah.
I don't think it's gonna, it can't happen until we're living in a post COVID travel restriction world.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it will happen on American soil where New Japan now has a promotion, New Japan Strong. Mm-hmm. And, I think it will be a co-promotion between that and AEW that Kenny will go over Kota. And Kenta will go over John Moxley on the same show. Like, that, it makes sense to try to, like, get all those things in together at the same time. That would be my guess. And maybe you bring over Okada to wrestle someone from AEW that he hasn't wrestled before either. And you have, like, a triple main event type of thing.
Who do you
want
to see Okada wrestle?
It's tough because a lot of the people at the top of the card, he wrestled in Japan now at this point.
What about MJF?
Yeah, I think that would do wonders for MJF.
It would do wonders for MJF, but also that could be a very interesting match.
Yeah.
If we're booking dream matches now.
I think that makes the most sense. But here's the other thing, too, is that both these people have to be champions for a prolonged time to make it happen. And here's my bold prediction. Kota Ibushi is this guy whose career as a character has been that he, like, can never quite win the big one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say it's going to be similar to the career of, like, Mick Foley as world champion, which seems like a weird person to compare him to, but someone else whose, like, thing was they could never win the big one.
Yeah.
And then when they did win it, they didn't hold it very long. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to predict that in the ultimate swervy way that New Japan sometimes likes to act in, particularly on their New Year's Dash show.
Oh no!
I think that Sonata is going to beat Kota Ibushi for the World Championship.
Isn't that like tonight?
It might be tonight. Like I might sound like an idiot by tomorrow.
Wow. I mean, just because that would crush me. It would break me. I am predicting. Because I like the idea of a rival show happening around WrestleMania time. I think April's too soon for this. I think maybe if not next Wrestle Kingdom, next April for around then. I think Kota, we could see a year-long reign for Kota here. I think, because, like, they've done it, Japan's done it before. Okada was champion for, like, 2 years. Like, I think this is a great time to let Kota show how good he is, give him like a year or longer reign. Kenny, the same thing with the AEW title. They keep picking up belts and you know, get this to like a head somewhere. But that's like ideal situation. You're probably right. He could very well lose it tonight.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm now trying to find the like the information about New Year's Dash. I don't know if it's actually been like confirmed. I mean, people keep talking about it, and Sonata is going to challenge him at it.
Maybe it's in like a week or something, because I just know it's always very soon after Wrestle Kingdom, so maybe it's in like a week or something.
Yeah. The other thing, I mean, we didn't even talk about this, that in his like post match, Jay White said that he in like character is like going to be done with New Japan after New Year's Dash. So whether or not that means he'll be doing spots elsewhere, again, I don't know how he could get anywhere else right now, but
yeah,
for him to show up with the other Bullet Club members in Impact would be really cool.
But also, I don't think he'd want to go anywhere else. Like, he's from New Zealand, and I hear things are great there. So.
Yeah, that's true.
He has no reason to go anywhere.
So I guess TBD, we're going to be staying tuned very much so to see what happens with Kota Ibushi and the gold.
Yes.
So I think, is it time?
Yes.
It's time to get into the bulk of our episode, a celebration and recap of the career and life of Brody Lee, Jonathan Huber, Luke Harper, and a few other names I'm not going to spoil right
now.
There
are a few other, yep.
Yeah. This is like much harder to talk about than I thought it was going to be, even this late. Okay, so he passed away on December 26th at age 41 in Jacksonville, Florida. He is survived by his wife, Amanda Huber, and a former professional wrestler in her own right, and his two children as well. And the cause of death is, I don't even know if they've gone into it further yet, that it is a non-COVID related lung issue, one that he had been receiving treatment for at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville since October.
Yeah.
A few
people have tried to, you know, expand upon that. I know, I think JR gave an interview or something, and like he knew a little bit more information. Just going off like context clues and stuff, they saying it's, you know, it's this is not a COVID thing. So it also, I'm pretty sure the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville is like one of the leading like cancer centers. I think people thought like, oh, maybe it was lung cancer, maybe, you know, something along that line, because again, he was very young, 41 years old, like peak athletic condition. He's a professional wrestler, so there's not a whole lot of information out, and I think that's fine. Like, however much his family wants to, you know, give out to the public is entirely up to them.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't want to sound like insensitive when I say this, but Mayo Clinics in general are places where you end up if things are, I was going to say if it's something similar that would make you like a character on an episode of House, but I don't mean to be insensitive by saying that, but like a Mayo Clinic is where you go when things are, when there's a mystery.
When options are running out.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just like where things are like things are not understood. And it seems to be, and I don't want to sound like I'm talking out of my butt either, but that if he was aware of this lung issue, then it was something that doctors didn't know exactly what it was, or it seemed like a surprise to everybody. And it's something that it's amazing to me. I think I'm echoing something that Jim Cornette said recently, which is maybe like one of the only times that I will be echoing Jim Cornette, but that it's something that is amazing, and not in like the super positive way, but in the truest sense of like being amazed. It is amazing that this is something that so many people in the business had knowledge that this was going on. Once he got checked into the clinic
and didn't say anything.
That it was the release of the information of his death seemed like a thought out, you know, something that they had been preparing for, you know, and that's crazy to think about.
I mean, it's sad. It sucks. He was very young, and I mean, we don't have children, but like, as you know, as you get older, you start to feel more for those situations of like, oh my God, he was 41. Like, I'm pretty close to that. And it was a shocking thing. Sarah and I have actually, we've been talking about this a lot because it's interesting. So for her, someone who's been watching wrestling fairly recently, she started, this is the first like unexpected wrestling death that she is that like, you know, been a part of. And so I've been telling her, like, I'm personally am seeing so many like similarities between when Eddie Guerrero died and this, mm-hmm. because
it feels a lot like that.
It was another guy who was very young. It was a very completely unexpected death. Just generally like loved by everyone backstage, in the audience. Like there's a lot of similarities between Eddie Guerrero's death as well.
It was a health failure. And I think that's important.
Yeah.
To distinct too, because I think the worst part about being a professional wrestling fan is the premature death of wrestlers, which is like a thing. David Shoemaker's made a whole career of it.
It happens a lot.
I think it's. I don't know. I was going to say, I think it's going to happen less and less because of the lack of drug abuse, that was so prevalent in the 70s and 80s of wrestlers that it seems like it's really swung the other way, where people seem particularly squeaky clean to be wrestlers now. Mm-hmm. But then you also have so many more nights performing and so many more bumps. Mm-hmm. That a body
so
is
many
taking
more harder bumps. I mean,
now compared to back then. So I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this won't be a, you know, silent age of premature wrestling deaths. Mm-hmm. But it does feel a lot like Eddie Guerrero's death. But we had seen a full career from Eddie Guerrero, and we really did not get to see the potential reached. Mm-hmm. For Brody Lee.
Well, I think for Eddie it was tough because Eddie was so good, and Eddie had already reached that metaphorical top. He had won the world championship, and he had been the guy and everything. But I mean, to be fair, I mean, I'm pretty sure Eddie was 38, 39 when he died. Like, Eddie still had a lot to do in his career. I mean, he had achieved, you know, this theoretical, you know, end goal, the top, the best you can, but I feel like he still had so much to do.
He really not in his 40s yet when he died? Wow.
I think he was
you're right, he was 38. That's crazy. I thought he was so like 45.
Wow. No, and so that was my thought of like, he still had a good 10 years, maybe 15 in him as well. Like, Eddie could have done so much. And for it's very much the same for Brody, but it is that also that level of like, Brody didn't really get to shine like we knew that he was capable of as a performer, you know, being a world champion or something like that.
It feels weird to compare it to other wrestler deaths, because like you could also compare it to the death of Bruiser Brody, who Mr. Brody Lee looked a whole lot like and wrestled in a similar way. He died at 42, but he also was like stabbed to death in a dispute. And you could definitely compare this to the death of Owen Hart in that this has been the wrestler death that has had the most universal kind of talk about how good of a family man John Huber was, and that being like his biggest contribution to the world is being like an amazing role model as a father. Yeah. And I think that is kind of the prevailing feeling that was at the death of Owen Hart as well. Mm-hmm. But you also had that was like I'm not going to get into that, but like a totally chaotic moment of like accidental death. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it does feel totally different than, or I guess it feels a little bit like each of those.
Doesn't make it any easier.
No, it actually, I think it makes it incredibly harder. It's and it also comes at a time that I don't think it's just like people in our age bracket who are like transitioning out of being like a young person to being like a young old person, you know, like like it's not just us who have had to really think about mortality mm-hmm. this year. I think it's that it is something that everyone of every age has kind of had to confront this year.
Sure. Yeah.
And even though this wasn't a COVID-related death, it I think it hurts more because of we are already thinking about this kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like a really really bad cherry on top of the horrible Sunday that was mm-hmm. 2020. But to try and pick things back up,
yeah,
to move to
yeah.
a little positive light. We do want to do a good look back into the career of Jonathan Huber, starting all the way at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
All the way to the end of it. And I did a lot of research on this. Going back into his early career is super interesting. He was born and raised in Rochester, New York. And being, you know, in the New York area, so close to a lot of different professional wrestling around there.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting, I thought, because I think I like tried to do the math. I think he got into wrestling around like 2006 or 2007. And if he died at 41 in 2020, then I think he was about 25, 26 when he started wrestling, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And math, not our strong suit, but we're doing our best.
Not strong suit. I am an accountant, but, you know.
Sorry, math's not my strong suit.
So he got started a little later as a professional wrestler, 26, 27. This is one of my favorite things. So his real name is Jonathan Huber. He actually began wrestling as a backyard wrestler, as so many wrestlers do, working under the name Huber Boy Number 2. And that is because he wrestled with his very real life brother, who was Huber Boy Number 1.
That's
a great name. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting name when like your tag team breaks up if you're just yeah. Huber Boy Number 2.
Well, it's like I'm sure that it's just a coincidence, but I wonder if John Huber just had a love affair with numerology and like mm-hmm. this is like something he brought back to use with the Dark Order.
Could be.
Or like,
well so one of my favorite wrestling podcasts, We Watch Wrestling, they are doing this thing right now where they're watching a lot of old Mid-South wrestling from the mm-hmm. 80s, and there is one performer in Mid-South back in the 80s, in the mid-80s, whose name was Mr. Wrestling 2. I think
yeah.
it was Mr.
Yeah,
Wrestling
yeah, Mr.
2.
Wrestling 2.
There was no Mr. Wrestling 1. He just for a while he was Mr. Wrestling 2. I think he then like changed his name to just Mr. Wrestling or Mr. Wrestling 1.
Yes,
but he
and
was
then
Mr.
Were,
Wrestling 2.
There was that was like the Patriot where there were then like the original Mr. Wrestling and
yeah.
like it became like a gimmick infringement yeah. kind of thing. Yeah,
maybe it's a throwback to that. Maybe John Huber was a big Mid-South fan, but
I'd believe that in a heartbeat.
Yeah. He started, so one of his first like big promotions he was with in the New York area was Rochester Pro Wrestling, RPW. And this is actually when he debuted under the name Brody Lee. So the origin of this name I love because we've already mentioned Brody Lee. John Huber had a striking resemblance towards Bruiser Brody.
Yeah.
Who was an older wrestler back in the day who was tragically murdered in a horrible incident down in
Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico.
Yeah. yeah.
But Brody Lee had a striking resemblance to him. It's very tall, crazy, like wild man hair.
Mm-hmm.
Similar wrestling style to him. So everyone obviously assumed like, oh, Brody Lee, it's after Bruiser Brody, but it's actually not. His name Brody Lee comes from the wonderful Kevin Smith movie Mallrats, one of my favorites, after actor Jason Lee, his character in the film Brody Bruce is what the name Brody Lee comes from.
You know, now you blew my mind with this because I also mm-hmm. just always assumed that he was named after Bruiser
right?
Brody.
Yeah.
I guess if you like I guess that he actually, in the face, looked pretty similar to Jason Lee.
He also had a resemblance to Jason Lee. That's right. Yeah. Like, if you think about it.
Like, because Jason, like, you think about, like, him and My Name is Earl.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, they have similar eyes.
It's wild to think about. But so if one thing we do know about Jonathan Huber, he was a big Kevin Smith fan.
I think it, like, shows his age.
Yes.
He is definitely, like, a person of the 90s. Yeah.
I think it's excellent. I love Mallrats. That's a great movie.
Yeah. I haven't watched that in quite... I guess I haven't watched any of the Kevin Smith movies in a while. Yeah. But I really liked Clerks and Chasing Amy growing up.
Clerks, Chasing Amy is great. Yeah. Mallrats, I'm a big fan of.
Yeah, Dogma's good, but I don't know. Let's not get into like a Kevin Smith
this
thing
isn't
here.
A Kevin Smith episode.
I'm also afraid to go back and watch any of those because I feel like they could very easily be unwatchable.
I think Clerks might hold up just because it was such like a here's the movie
low budget thing. Yeah. Yeah.
But moving on, we don't want to get too down that rabbit hole.
Former AEW wrestler Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
their time in AEW didn't overlap.
In 2007, Brody Lee began working with Philadelphia-based Chikara Pro, which I don't think Chikara's not a thing anymore, right?
No. We'll get into that at some point, I feel like.
But so Chikara's not a thing anymore, but they were...
They got Me Too'd out of wrestling.
Yeah, yeah. They were a fairly prominent-esque promotion. I would say like, clearly nothing like, you know, Ring of Honor or WWE or even, but they were a fairly well-known promotion.
Yeah, well, I think that they used a lot of the same talent as Ring of Honor, and they both kind of came about at the same time. And I think that if Ring of Honor was the early 2000s super serious, mat-based indie, then Chikara was the polar opposite, right? It's like everyone works really... like cartoony gimmicks, and it's supposed to be family-friendly wrestling, and like there's a stable of ants. Like I know that much about it, and like
But so he started working with Chikara Pro in 2007. There was a whole lot more to like what he had done there, but one of the really cool talking points that I saw, mostly because I was able to find the match, is that Brody Lee participated in Chikara's first ever cage match with Claudio Castagnoli, who you
the
might
Swiss
know
banker.
As Cesaro in WWE, back in 2008. And you can find this match. It's on
I'm watching it right now. I pulled it up as you started talking about it.
It's great. It was a great cage match. You can clearly tell it's like one of the like dinkiest cages.
Yeah. It's barely holding on. It's amazing to see John Huber this thin and with him with less hair. And Claudio Castagnoli with more hair is an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah,
it's funny. This is around the same time that this is a tangent to go on, but it's fun. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put it in this episode. Around the same time, Cesaro appears in the Darren Aronofsky movie, The Wrestler. Mm-hmm. And he's in the credits. And I didn't know who he was then when I saw the movie. And then not recently, but in the last few years, I watched it again. I watched it with Chelsea, who had not seen it since watching wrestling.
Came out, yeah.
Well, yeah. And, like, she loved it then, but didn't have the, like, context of pro wrestling for that.
Right,
so then we watched it, and I was like, Cesaro's in this movie somewhere. And we could not find him. And then we did find him, and we missed it because he has a bunch of hair. So we just, like, couldn't even tell that it was him. Because he had some gorgeous locks.
He did.
In there.
He did have to, used to have some very long locks. But yeah, it's a great cage match. I recommend watching it. That was really good.
It's also amazing that his costume here is exactly the same as Luke Harper.
He brought the exact look over for Luke Harper, which I mean it. More power to him. It worked out perfect that he happened to join like a backwoods country cult.
Yeah.
Like that he didn't even have to change his outfit.
No. They're like, he's like, this is all I got with me. And they're like, that's fine.
Some of his other history working at Chikara, he later after this cage match, he had at one point was part of a stable, the Roughnecks, with one Grizzly Redwood. So I actually don't know who that is. I had looked at the name, but I couldn't find much on them. And one, Eddie Kingston. So it's,
I'll say that Grizzly Redwood looks exactly
as
like
it
how
sounds.
You think he would look.
I genuinely thought when I first read it, I was like, is that Eric Rowan before he's Eric Rowan?
No, it was Mitch Franklin is that. Okay. I've seen his name pop up on cards before.
Okay.
I think he still wrestles as Grizzly Redwood right now. Yeah.
But so that's interesting. I thought just for some context of the relationships that Luke Harper, Bertie Lee had with other wrestlers and how far back they went. Because you see, you know, when these things happen, they do a lot of interviews where they talk to people and, you know, like what Brody meant to them and the things they wish they could say. And one of them that I was interested in was Eddie Kingston. And I had no idea the history that they had going all the way back to 2008, 2009 and being in a stable and like having feuds. There's another great match that you can find on YouTube as well. That's Brody Lee versus Eddie Kingston for, I think it's called the Mega Championship or something.
It sounds pretty big.
Yeah. But they have a singles match in front of like 30 people, but it's a really good match. It's excellent. It's like 22, 23 minutes long. But I had no idea the history that they had between each other. So that's an interesting context that I thought. And also another thing that I found that was crazy, I had no idea the amount of companies that Brody had worked for, who had done spots for. In research, he had worked for Squared Circle Wrestling, 2CW, Ring of Honor, Evolve, Dragon Gate USA, Jersey All Pro Wrestling, Chikara, RPW, WWE. Like, I had no idea the breadth of his work.
What's crazy in that to me is that Combat Zone Wrestling is not one of the ones that he was in.
Oh my god, he'd have been perfect.
Because that seems like, if you had told me that he had been there for like 10 years in like super death matches, I would have been like,
yeah,
that sounds about right.
Of course.
I think it is interesting. I also didn't know that he had worked in Japan. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about his Jersey All Pro Wrestling stable, which is... did you see about this?
No, I didn't.
He was in... I imagine this was not for that long, really. Mm-hmm. This was leading up into his storyline with Eddie Kingston, that he was part of a kind of a precursor trio to the Wyatt family.
Oh.
He was part of the Hillbilly Wrecking Crew. And this was in 2009. So
are they cultists or are they construction?
I think they're construction because the other two members, this is crazy that these three people were in a stable for a year in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
He was with Trevor Murdoch. So this must have been right after
wow.
he left WWE.
Mm-hmm.
And Necro Butcher.
Oh my god.
What a weird.
What a combo.
Yeah. Necro Butcher. Well, I feel like we should do a show about like weird indie hardcore legends at some point.
Necro Butcher, Super Dragon.
Yeah, Necro Butcher, who my favorite part of his like homicidal redneck persona is that he would wear a shirt to the ring that was a parody of pro-lifers that would say choose death. And that's about sums up who Necro Butcher was.
Yeah, that's wild.
So but eventually he does make the jump from indies to mm-hmm. to New York, right?
Yep.
So he debuts as Luke Harper for the first time in May of 2012 for Florida Championship Wrestling, which, you know, later becomes NXT.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon. So like Harper was only in FCW for a few months, which is like good for him, because from everyone who still talks about it, it sounds like that was a really great move to NXT.
Mm-hmm.
So he was first recruited as the first son of the Wyatt family faction in mm-hmm. November 2012, and then eventually Eric Rowan joins as well, and you have the NXT version of the Wyatt family.
Yes,
which is
family
not that different from the main roster version.
No.
I would say that like Bray Wyatt's shirts were a little bit more colorful in NXT.
yeah
and
he
that might be
had,
like the only difference.
And he still had the fedora. I don't mm-hmm. know if did the rocking chair, was that an NXT thing, or did that not come out till main roster?
That may have been on the main roster.
It may have just been a main roster thing.
He definitely looked like, if you caught him on the wrong night in NXT, he could look like the lead singer of Smash Mouth. Like,
okay.
Right? Is that, I feel like that's not too off base.
No. There's a lot of ska undertones.
Yeah. So in NXT, Harper and Rowan defeat Adrian Neville and Bo Dallas on May 8th, 2013 to win the NXT Tag Team Championships. Mm-hmm. And they hold those for quite a while. Do they drop them to the Ascension?
I don't think it was the Ascension. I think they lost them. I want to say they lost them back to Neville and someone.
Mm-hmm.
But I could be wrong. Wasn't Neville and Sami Zayn a tag team for like a split second before they were feuding over the NXT title?
Let's see. It seems like they lost them to Adrian Neville and Oliver Gray.
Oh, that's what it was. I remember I saw it and I was like, who is Oliver Gray?
He was a British person in NXT.
He was Grizzly Redwood.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got that wrong. Harper and Rowan lost the NXT tag team title too. And you got this right. You knew that Neville tagged with someone more notable. They lost it to Neville and Corey Graves.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there you go. But eventually they do make it onto the main roster. Mm-hmm. Pretty quickly, honestly. Their main roster debut is July 8th, 2013, where they attacked Kane on Raw after weeks of very creepy video vignettes. And then they go on as a tag team, Harper and Rowan go on an undefeated streak until October 11th of 2013, where they lose to Cody Rhodes and Goldust. And then we get Harper as the first member of the Wyatt family to win singles gold, right?
Mm-hmm. And so this is a weird time because this is already, I think this was after the first time that Bray Wyatt had quote unquote set them free, Harper and Rowan that being. And because I remember it was like a promo he gave and he said the phrases like, I am setting them free. And people expect like, oh, is this the end of the Wyatt family or what happens? And so this singles championship reign, Brody Lee held the Intercontinental Championship. He is a former Intercontinental Champion.
Well, Luke Harper held the...
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Yes, yeah. Luke Harper. He is a former Intercontinental Champion, though it was short-lived. But so the way that this match came to about was really crazy. So the night, basically, Harper had been pseudo-set free from the Wyatt family. And this is when the Authority was still very much dominating the main storyline and the main roster. And so what it was, Harper had sort of given them his allegiance to say, like, I'm willing to help you guys or something. And so after he declared his allegiance to the Authority, they gave him an impromptu title match that same night against the Intercontinental Champion Dolph Ziggler. In the match, with the assistance of the interference of Seth Rollins, who was the face of the Authority at the time, Luke Harper became the Intercontinental Champion. I knew he was Intercontinental Champion, but I didn't remember how it came about. And I after reading that, I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I don't remember him being with the Authority at all, which is crazy, even if it was just for like that evening.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Of course, given that he did lose the title back to Ziggler 27 days later at TLC.
In a match that I brought up like 400 times before on this podcast, and I will bring it up again, that this was my favorite match of 2013. It's an unbelievable ladder match, and if you are out there looking to watch Luke Harper, Brody Lee matches in the wake of his death, start with this one. It's so, so good.
TLC 2014.
But
so after that there's a small hiatus with the Wyatt family. Eventually they do reform for the second iteration of the Wyatt family, and again we're trying to do like a Cliff Notes version of this here. Since we have broken down the history of the Wyatt family before, but just giving context of Harper's role within it. The second version of the Wyatt family is, of course, when they added Braun Strowman, the black sheep of the Wyatt family, because he had the black mask. And also, he was the biggest dude in the family.
Yeah, suddenly he made three giants look tiny.
He was massive. He was huge. The Wyatt family were now a four person group, and this was, to be fair, one of the strongest the iterations that the Wyatt family had ever been, obviously because of the numbers and just the size of all of them. This was unfortunately brought to a premature end for Harper, being that he eventually suffered a knee injury, which sidelined him for about 6 months during this whole storyline. And then I think during that time away, the family continued to implode. Braun went his separate ways, as did Rowan and so forth.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that Harper wasn't even involved in the dissolution of the Wyatt family, because he just wasn't on TV. I mean, that is going to, not to do a spoiler alert, but a big part of the rest of his WWE career is him being at home, either from injury or from the old adage of creative having nothing for you, right? So we'll get to that in a second, though. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump ahead.
No problem. And then, so after, once Harper is healed, he returns, and this is the third iteration, I guess you will, of the Wyatt family. And this one involves another one of those situations of WWE dropping the ball on what could have been an incredible storyline.
Yeah.
This was the Orton infiltration of the Wyatt family storyline. Mm-hmm. So this storyline is Bray is feuding with Randy Orton. They have a grudge match at No Mercy that Bray wins with the assistance of Harper, who has just returned from injury.
Mm-hmm.
And so after having defeated Orton, now Bray has, I can't remember if like the stipulation was you lose, you have to join the Wyatt family or something
I think it was,
or if it was like a
like
slow
that.
Burn of like Bray taking control of Randy.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, Orton does join the Wyatt family. Him and Bray win the SmackDown Tag Team Championships at TLC.
Mm-hmm.
And after they win the titles, Harper, who is back, and this is now the new three-person Wyatt family, is sanctioned champion as well under the Freebird rule, so all three of them are the tag team champion.
Although, if I remember correctly, too, that Harper never fully trusts Orton.
Nope. Yeah. Never.
And Orton's
fully
trying to be like, I totally am about this. Like, yes. I didn't think I was going to be into this, but actually, I'm down with you guys because I'm also a psychopath.
Yep. Because Harper was using his brain, and he's watched the show before. He knows Orton's history, so yeah. he's never fully on board with Randy, but he's putting up with him. They do have the tag belts. There's, you know, things to celebrate, I guess. Ultimately, Orton and Harper, because again, Harper is now sanctioned as the champion on the Freebird rule, Orton and Harper defend the belts and lose them to American Alpha. You remember that tag team?
Yeah, man. They should have been
so much bigger.
Jason Jordan's, it will be a thing for another time. Yeah.
Yeah. So they eventually lose the belts to American Alpha, and then that begins the real dissension between them and the implosion of the Wyatt family again, with Orton and Harper being at odds, with Bray trying to play the peacekeeper between them. Eventually, this leads to Orton and Harper. They had a singles match on SmackDown where Orton won, and then after the match, Wyatt attacked Harper after the match, effectively kicking him out of the Wyatt family, saying, it's just me and Orton now.
And then you have babyface Luke Harper out of nowhere.
For the first time in his entire WWE career, you have a face Luke Harper. And so here is where things start to go wrong. The timeline, Randy Orton wins the Royal Rumble. He gets the right to challenge the champion at WrestleMania. Him and Harper are still feuding at this time because, again, Harper's been kicked out of his family. Orton is still there. Harper still thinks Orton is manipulating Bray in a very odd role reversal here. And so they eventually have a grudge match at Elimination Chamber. I think Orton wins that match.
Mm-hmm.
But the main story of that night, Elimination Chamber, is that same night Bray Wyatt wins his very first WWE championship.
I think from John Cena.
I think Cena was the champion going in.
Because Cena got his 16th reign right before this. I think that I'm right about that.
I think so.
Yeah.
And so Bray wins his first WWE championship, Elimination Chamber. So now we have Bray, the WWE champion, Randy Orton, the Royal Rumble winner, and everyone, like, the potential for the storyline here is so excellent because this was your chance, WWE, to push Luke Harper, who is turning face. He is getting a very good crowd reaction. People like Luke Harper. He's a great worker. This is the first time we get a chance to see him as a face and see how he performs under that role. I thought he had momentum. He did. Mm-hmm. Like, people wanted Harper to win. And ultimately, this leads to Harper had a number one contendership match against AJ Styles on, like, a Raw or a SmackDown or something. And he loses this match. And that's kind of how they killed the storyline.
Yeah.
Luke Harper goes on to lose in the Andre the Battle Royal at WrestleMania.
The armbar.
Orton and Bray go on to have one of the worst matches in WrestleMania history.
I think if that match, that WrestleMania match, wasn't so bad, I don't think that we would remember this as a poor storyline.
Because
I actually think it's a really great long-term story from WWE that just, like, really fails at the very final moment.
As they often do.
But here's the thing, like, let's play devil's advocate. If Luke Harper had been added to the WrestleMania match and it was a three-way, mm-hmm.
yeah.
and the match is a flop, is it like, does he get blamed?
I feel like there's potential that maybe someone backstage might or something like that, but I feel like the potential positives outweighed the potential negatives in this situation. Like, there's no reason that a triple threat match between Harper, Orton, and Bray, concluding this huge Wyatt family storyline that you've been telling, there's no way that a worst case scenario for that, like, is worse than the worst case scenario of Orton and Bray, which almost was the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
It just felt like such, and especially in retrospect now, like, it just felt like such a waste, and like another situation of WWE where this is the time. You have these incredible performers who have worked at the company for years and years and years, and you can't, obviously, not everyone can be a top guy at the same time, so you have to wait for the right moment for each person. And this was the moment for Luke Harper, I thought, personally.
Yeah, I agree with you. It felt like the time to pull the trigger. And I think that particular road to WrestleMania, WWE showed a real inability to be limber. Like, they had very clear storylines they planned really far out, and they weren't able to pivot in a way that they were even 2 years later with Kofi Mania. Mm-hmm. Because if you remember, So Luke Harper is ascending, and at the same time, the hottest act is Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho, Festival of Friendship,
yep.
and uh-huh. then they take the title off of Kevin Owens before WrestleMania, which I guess they had to get to Goldberg versus Brock.
They didn't have to.
Yeah, but like, did. The two kind of hottest storylines really
yeah.
kind of took a dive so that WrestleMania could happen.
Yeah. But yeah, so that was the upsetting ending to that storyline, but eventually Harper does still get another good run when he forms a tag team with Rowan, when they came back as the Bludgeon Brothers.
If you like hammers, they
do
were
you like
your
hammers
because yeah.
they got them.
Yeah.
But so I think this was, to be fair, this was a great run for them. They had a 135-day reign as the SmackDown Tag Team Champions.
They went over the New Day a few times.
Went over the New Day too. A few times, yeah. who, to be fair, were probably one of the biggest acts in the company at the time. Yeah. So they did fairly well. But again, unfortunately, this being sidelined as well by another injury, Rowan was injured, ultimately putting the entire tag team on a hiatus. And then we never really saw John or Luke Harper in WWE again.
Yeah, he gets sent to the sideline. They don't have anything for him because they think of him as needing Eric Rowan to mm-hmm. to exist as a character. In 2018, he makes a few spot appearances at NXT house shows, like fighting Ricochet, Dijakovic, in a like a really good like pre-WrestleMania or like WrestleMania access match with Dominik Dijakovic, who had just been signed. And it's like, oh, this guy clearly is back in shape and ready to be on TV again.
Yeah.
He shows up in the armbar at WrestleMania 35. And then he wrestles in a dark match against EC3 before an episode of SmackDown that apparently Vince McMahon like hated that match. Ugh. So then he canceled the creative plans he had for both of them.
Oh my God.
So after that, Harper requests a release. He's not granted it. They add time onto his contract for injury. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is I had totally forgot that he does show back up on TV a few weeks before he's eventually granted his release. Mm-hmm. He shows up. He attacks Roman Reigns at the end of a pay-per-view. He ambushes Daniel Bryan. And
with Bray or alone? I don't
with Eric Rowan. This is after Clash of Champions. And then there's a match at Hell in a Cell where Harper and Rowan like are defeated by new best friends, Roman Reigns and Daniel Bryan. Oh. And then like right after that, I guess his last match is in the Battle Royal at Crown Jewel on October 31st. And then he's released. But I don't remember any of that.
I don't either,
So then he gets to AEW. You want to take us into his short career in AEW?
Yeah. So at this point, AEW has been around for a little bit. COVID is now a thing. It's so weird to talk about this in like the retrospect, because like it was last year basically, but it felt so long ago. But like I still vividly remember it. It's like, God, we were just in that, weren't we? But yes, so this is in March. COVID is still a very thing. This is the COVID era of professional wrestling.
Well, it's just starting, too, like the COVID era.
It's just starting,
yep.
There are no audiences. AEW is doing all of their Dynamite shows primarily from Daily's place with employees around the ring, other wrestlers, backstage hands, serving as an audience. He debuts on March 18th, 2020, as the they've been leading up to this week. So who is the Exalted One? Who is the leader of the Dark Order? A lot of people, there's all these hints that it could be Matt Hardy, but it turns out to be Brody Lee.
Mr. Brody Lee.
And so it also interesting as well, because a lot of people thought it would be Matt Hardy. Matt Hardy debuted that same night as well, just not as the leader of the Dark Order.
Was that only their second or third show into quarantine?
It was March 18th, so it had to be fairly soon.
And it was supposed to originally be in Rochester, New York, the hometown
of Brody Lee.
It's tragic that Brody Lee never got to wrestle in front of the live audience.
That was the other thing that I wanted to say, that it's crazy to think about, because it feels like he had done so much in that company, and to be fair, he did. Brody Lee never once got to wrestle in front of the full audience for AEW, and that is just...
It's criminal.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But after debuting in March as leader of the Dark Order, he did go on to do a whole lot of good things. He had a good undefeated streak going for a little while. He suffered his first loss, of course, to Jon Moxley at their AEW championship match at Double or Nothing. I remember you and I talking about this. That was one of our favorite matches of the night.
It's going to be on my ballot for match of the year.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll be in my number one slot, but it's definitely making it.
I remember that we both really liked that match. I remember spots from that match were great. I remember that was the match that you and I were both worried.
The table weight.
One of them were going to get impaled on that mic weight thing.
Yeah.
So he then went on to do arguably the biggest part of his AEW career on August 22nd. I wrote defeated. I'm going to say squashed Cody Rhodes on Dynamite to become the TNT champion. I remember that moment just because, like, I kind of felt like Brody was going to win because Cody had won a lot of matches, and it was like, God, Brody needs this. And he did it in a fashion I never thought he would. Cody was, like, the guy, the face of this company, and Brody squashed him. It was an excellent match. I remember watching it. It was super entertaining. He held that belt for a 55-day reign, losing it on August 7th.
October 7th.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. On October 7th, and this being his final match ever, lost the TNT Championship back to Cody Rhodes in a dog collar match.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, it's what we know. He was off TV since. A lot of people speculated maybe he had suffered some sort of injury during that match, and so he was going to go away for a little bit until ultimately we received the news about his passing.
Yeah. I wonder, I'm sure more of this will come out, if he knew that. I don't know if he knew that that was going to be his final match. I don't know if he
no,
knew
I don't
that
think so.
That his condition was as fatal as it was.
Yeah.
But I think he knew he was going to be out of action for some time. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember us even on this podcast being confused as to why
Cody won the belt back.
Yeah, why they would hotshot this so quickly. And it's like, clearly we didn't know everything that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. A daily reminder that sometimes the booking decisions have to do with more than what makes the most sense for the characters on screen.
And more than what any of us would be ever privy to. So.
Yeah. So then last week, AEW runs for Dynamite their Celebration of the Life of Brody Lee episode.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fantastic episode of television that I highly recommend going
good.
And watching. What was your favorite part?
My favorite part was probably Rowan coming out for the tag match with John Silver, Reynolds, and Hangman.
I do love Chris Jericho being like, "It's Eric Rowan," and then
Redbeard,
Eric Redbeard,
Redbeard, it's Eric Rowan, Redbeard,
Redbeard, like, Redbeard.
They kept trying to correct him, but
yeah,
I think that was my favorite moment because it was both a really heartfelt moment and also it still fulfilled all the beautiful things about professional wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
The shock appearances of like the surprise wrestler, like it got me hyped and I popped for it. And at the same time, I felt so many emotions knowing like their connection and, oh man, it was a very, very good moment. To be
mm-hmm.
fair, I thought all the matches were really good.
Yeah,
the Colt Cabana.
A star-making turn for Colt Cabana, which is a weird thing to say about someone who's been around forever.
It was an excellent match, and Colt, the emotion was on his face, the tears were showing at his entrance, and from that point, like, oh man, everything just hit so much harder and. It was a very, like, top to bottom, this was an excellent show.
Mm-hmm. There's something that I want to applaud both companies, like WWE and AEW, for both doing a lot to celebrate his life and definitely, like, putting down their guns to allow each other to use footage and,
mm-hmm.
you know, reference each other to make it a complete tribute. But here's why I loved this tribute show more than other tribute shows for wrestlers' deaths in the past. That the main event was booked by Brody Lee's son.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, "Who do you want to see fight?" And like this whole show felt like a gift to the family rather than for the at-home audience. This
mm-hmm.
was like, this is a thing that you're going to be able to hold on to forever. And like the inclusion of his son minus one, negative one,
negative one.
to use him throughout the show over and over the way that they did.
Yeah, getting spots with like MJF and stuff like that was
great. And it's like something that I mean I have no business to be outraged about this still, but something that to this day really I don't feel great about
mm-hmm.
is on the Eddie Guerrero death episode that the main event was between Kurt Angle, who is someone who was very close with Eddie,
mm-hmm.
and Shawn Michaels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Shawn Michaels, they're like, well, he became close with Eddie in like the last few weeks because they talked about religion.
Yeah.
But it definitely, it's like, why was it not Chavo Guerrero?
or Rey Mysterio.
Yeah,
or like,
yeah, for a night. Or maybe it was Shawn Michaels versus Rey Mysterio. There was one person who felt like it made sense.
Yeah, and then
in
the other,
match, and then the other one was Shawn Michaels. So yeah. Like this did feel like it served the family in spite of any way it could have negatively affected AEW,
yeah.
Which I don't think it did. I think it really
it was a lot of people have been saying like this is like the best tribute show mm-hmm. that a promotion has put on, and I personally do agree. It was top to bottom excellent,
yeah. And it has put the Dark Order in a position to be amazing baby faces. Like
yes.
I don't think that the plan was going to be to have Hangman join the Dark Order, but now I kind of hope he does.
Maybe now.
Now
so
I hope he does.
Here's
yeah.
This has been a speculation that like Sarah and I have been talking about is where does the Dark Order go now? And ultimately, I think this is one of those weird moments, and it's again, it's unfortunate that it comes from something as sad as this. It's one of those weird moments that can be a catalyst for mm-hmm. a performer or a group of performers right now. And again, it's obvious this is a bad, like you don't never want this to happen, but Dark Order has the most buzz around it now as it's ever had.
Yeah.
And so this is a moment where you can choose like what do we want for this going forward? You can decide to make a face turn for them. I wanted to talk a little bit about like Dark Order's role with like BTE and mm-hmm. stuff, the Being the Elite YouTube show, where they really found themselves and a voice for their characters on that they then brought to Dynamite. But that voice kind of in a weird juxtaposition to what Dark Order originally felt like was a comedic voice.
Yeah,
it was an amazing
comedy group now.
Yeah, it was we realized like, wow, John Silver is hilarious, and like Brody Lee, rather than being a cult leader of all these like dangerous cultists, having to be a leader of all these like comic buffoons,
a manager of underlings, like
it's so much more funny and compelling and entertaining. And so this is another chance. Like you can decide at this point to do we want to change that now? Do we want to make this our serious push for the Dark Order being a serious threats and competitors? And it made me think, and again, it made me think of again Eddie's death. How, if you remember, after Eddie Guerrero died, it was he died fairly soon after that heated blood feud with Rey Mysterio.
Yeah,
over
yeah.
Dominic's.
Eddie
custody.
Was like a really realistic villain at the point.
It was
that
a
he died.
It was a
yeah.
heated rivalry. He had just finished with Rey Mysterio,
mm-hmm.
and so after his death, after Eddie's passing, Rey. To be fair, Rey was excellent. He was a fan favorite. People loved Rey Mysterio. But mm-hmm. Rey had never been a main eventer at this point. And so after Eddie's death was when Rey was pushed to the moon. Rey
yeah.
won the Royal Rumble that year, then went on to win the World Heavyweight Championship at WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that, obviously, I'm not saying he's not deserving of it, but I think it's fair to say objectively that had Eddie's passing not occurred, Rey would not have been put in that spot.
Yeah. I think people like that storyline more now than they did the time, because I think it won the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Award for mm-hmm. most shameless promotional tactic for
Ugh.
Like, but like it, wrestling is a art form that more so in recent years is all about playing off of what you think these people are like in real life, right?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. and you gotta remember that all these people have a bit of a carny mentality.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think AEW will do anything that the Huber family would say no to. I think they will use Brody Lee's death in storylines
mm-hmm.
to heighten characters. But I don't think they will do it in a way that makes the audience feel queasy about
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, you can tell, like you know it, you feel it. You're like, this isn't right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so going off that point, we're talking about what is next for the Dark Order. And so the immediate thought is of course that they're going to need to fill the void, not
mm-hmm.
necessarily like find a replacement of Mr. Brody, but, you know, find someone who could maybe take that leader role over. And immediately, my immediate thoughts are potentials. Hangman Page.
Mm-hmm.
If Hangman does come into the group now, and he starts to, they start to see him as sort of this like mentor role, and he can take over. Other option, Eric Rowan. I'm not sure if he had signed anything with the company. I think, to our knowledge right now, his appearance on the tribute show was just like a one-off.
It was just that, yeah.
But it, there is potential there. He was let go from WWE earlier this year. There is potential for him to come in and try to fill that role. I'm almost, I like we were just saying, I do kind of get the queasy feeling from that decision.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would be a fan of Rowan doing that. And then a third option, which I don't want to really go into it, but just like in a past life of fantasy booking, like Marty Scurll would have been interesting as the leader of the Dark Order.
Yeah, he's the other person who was rumored to be the leader. Then he clearly is now a free agent in a sense, but I don't think it will be him.
No, I don't think so. But my point on that was, if that is the direction, I think we're not going to see that for a while.
Yeah.
It's far too soon in the next week or two. But even, I would say, even by Revolution, maybe, it might be a little too soon to have someone trying to take that leader role.
Mm-hmm.
But
the only person who makes sense in the immediate is Hangman.
Yeah.
But I think it'd be interesting to see if they roll just like internally promoting a leader. I mean, they really are like a corporate cult, and we make it sound like it now.
We promote, like, from within.
I mean, Evil Uno is like the vice president basically of them anyway, but like John Silver has been just like knocking it out of the park recently. Yeah. Alex Reynolds has been hitting his stride. Mm-hmm. Colt Cabana, as we said, could easily be a leader, especially if they're gonna really tap into the comedy side. So
Preston Vance, number 10, had a very good showing in the main event of Dynamite that he was in. I do quick side note that I actually have to say, because we had to do a little more research into Preston Vance. This is coming straight from our AEW correspondent.
Great.
Sarah is a firm belief that it is a crime to put that man under a mask, because he is a very handsome man.
I'm going to have to Google Preston Vance without a mask now.
He's a very handsome man.
Yeah.
This is akin to like Andrade being under a mask for years. Like,
yeah. All right. Well, that I think about brings us to current times again. Time without Brody Lee. I feel like we should rush to the finish now. I don't know if there's anything left really to say about him.
I mean, I don't know. It's again, I think we've said everything, and I mean, there's
oh, you know what? There's one thing that we should absolutely say.
Yes.
Is that the official shirt, Wrestling Tees is selling right now. All the proceeds are going to his family, correct?
So as is, Mick Foley and CM Punk have also donated all of their merch.
There may be a few
other
people too.
For the next month or so, will also be going directly to the Huber family.
Yeah. So if you've been thinking about buying some wrestling T-shirts, now is the time to do it and help them out.
And honestly, those shirt designs are really cool.
Yeah, they're cool shirts.
Yeah. But I was just gonna say, I mean, there are countless videos online that you can find of far better people than us to talk about how great Brody was. A lot of like other wrestlers talking about their personal relationships with him. I've personally just been viewing like AEW's tribute video. WWE has put out two now with different superstars talking to him, and oh man, it's
the tribute video with Tom Waits, because Tony Khan paid to get the perpetuity license for that Tom Waits song.
Yep.
Yeah,
and it just hits hard.
All right, well, I don't even have anything to plug. I feel like it'd be in poor taste to do so. Let's just leave you in the words of the immortal William Shakespeare. If wrestling be the food of love, fight on.
Stay safe out there. We love you.